All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons, and this is Aaron Freeman, your host. And today is another Q&A episode where I'll be answering listener questions pertaining to your beloved Atlanta Falcons.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com. One of the longest running Falcon websites on the internet. Of course, the host of this illustrious podcast. And also, you can find me on Twitter at FalcFans. So, guys, we're going to do another Q&A episode to wrap up the week. Got a lot of questions, or a couple of questions this week that I'll be able to dive a little deeper on to fill up the half hour of this episode. As you guys know, if I don't get to a question on this episode, then you can, of course, send some more, and I will answer on a leftover mailbag later this weekend on LockedOnFalcons.com. Of course, the way that you can get in touch by contacting me with your questions, comments, or suggestions about this podcast or things that you want answered, you can use Twitter, of course, FalcFans. If it's podcast-related, just let me know in the tweet, and I'll save it for the mailbag. If it is podcast related, it's just easier to go ahead and send it over to Locked On Falcons. That's the show's Twitter handle. Of course, you can also post on Facebook at Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. You also have email address. That's LockedOnFalcons@mail.com. And of course, you can leave a comment on LockedOnFalcons.com or FalcFans.com, the two websites where the show is posted daily. Okay, guys. Let's get into it. This question came prior to the previous mailbag, and I just, you know, got too caught up and didn't answer it. Sorry about that, Chris. But from Chris Hedden, he asks, I know you've talked numerous times about how the Falcons need cornerback depth going forward and better nickel play. What's the chances of the Falcons looking at a guy like Alabama's Levi Wallace in the fourth or fifth round to fill that spot? I think there's a decent chance. Wallace certainly has the length requirements that the Falcons typically look for in an outside corner, standing 6 feet tall and having nearly 33-inch arms, typically what the Falcons are looking for with their outside corners, at least under Dan Quinn, is guys that are 6'1", 6'2", or taller, and also have 32-inch arms or longer. And while, you know, Wallace basically hits those requirements, I think of all the four draftable Bama defensive back, or five if we count Ronnie Harrison, the safety, but I was thinking more of Minkah Fitzpatrick, Harrison, Anthony Averett, Tony Brown, and Wallace. I think probably Wallace would probably rank fifth from my perspective based off what I've seen. I haven't watched a ton of any of those guys, but I've seen some of them. And, you know, I would probably be more content with Wallace in the fifth or sixth round range, more so than the fourth round range, but because the Falcons don't have a fifth-round pick, if they pulled the trigger on him at the end of round four, I guess I couldn't complain too much about that. That tends to happen, particularly if there's a run on cornerbacks, you know, at some point, maybe on day two of the draft. Again, I haven't really watched a ton of Wallace. He's not necessarily a guy that excites me as far as, you know, coming in and playing that, you know, challenging Brian Poole for that nickel cornerback spot. I feel like he's kind of a lateral move in that sense, because just because he's like a bigger guy, and so he brings something different to the table, but I don't necessarily know if he's going to be a significant upgrade over what Brian Poole currently brings. You know, at least as a, you know, Wallace would come in and play outside corner, and then you would have a guy like Alford or Trufant slide in and play the slot in the nickel situations. And I feel like if you drafted Wallace still, you're going to be looking to upgrade that nickel cornerback spot probably 2 years from now as well. So it's kind of a lateral move in my opinion. But, you know, generally speaking, I think you're not really going to be making massive upgrades to your roster once you start drafting guys on day three of the draft. It's just sort of you're supplementing a roster as opposed to making significant upgrades. So Wallace definitely fits in line with that, I think. Okay, our next question comes from Rory Simmons. He asks, is linebacker a dark horse for the Falcons round one selection if no defensive tackle prospects or trade offers come our way? I don't think so. You know, I would certainly hope not. I think the team has shown some interest in guys like Leighton Vander Esch from Boise State and Rashawn Evans from Alabama, two linebackers that are projected to go in round one. I think expectations and scuttlebutt around Vander Esch is he'll go somewhere in the back half of round one, maybe top 15. You know, a team like Green Bay has been connected with him at pick 14. But the expectations I've read are sort of he'll go somewhere between pick 14 and 28. And Rashawn Evans will probably go some point at the back half of the first round. A lot of people have been projecting, including myself, to be the Steelers pick at pick 28, to be their sort of Ryan Shazier replacement. So they're certainly in the mix for where the Falcons are picking. I personally kind of think that they're doing their due diligence more than necessarily seriously looking at either one of those guys as their first round pick. I think both guys, the thing that they have going for them, they're sort of the athletic prototypes that I think the Falcons sort of will be looking for, particularly Van Der Esch playing the Sam linebacker spot and Rashawn Evans playing that weak side linebacker spot. But I think it's more due diligence looking at some of the top-end players to better stack their board. We did this last year with guys like Garrett Bowles and Cam Robinson. Maybe, in those guys' cases, the Falcons were sort of working them out to see if they could possibly play some guard. But I think, in all honesty, they were first-round offensive tackles that would have probably not been guys that you would have Bowles, I thought Bowles could have probably played some guard. Robinson, not so much. So it kind of felt like they were doing more of their due diligence then. I'm trying to think who else. Oh, like in 2016, they were looking at guys like Jack Conklin and Will Fuller and Eli Apple as well. I don't think they had Apple or Fuller in for private workouts, but I know they talked to them at the combine. And I don't think any of those guys were really sort of on their radar at that point either. So I do think this is something the Falcons tend to do, which is do their due diligence on some of these guys. I think if you're going to draft a linebacker in round one, you got to be pretty convinced that that guy, whether it's Van Der Esch, basically in the case of Van Der Esch, that he's going to be Anthony Barr 2.0, or in the case of Rashawn Evans, that he's going to be Telvin Smith 2.0, because you're not going to get, unless they live up to that expectation and have that sort of instant impact in year one or year two, and be considered one of the top linebackers in the league. By that point, you're not really going to net the value that you're looking for with a first-round pick. I think if you, especially when you consider the fact that the Falcons could potentially, if they wanted to, if they clear up enough cap space to do so, possibly, who knows? I don't know I don't know when the time frame is, because I think you kind of need to make this move by draft day, and I don't know if the Falcons are going to clear up enough cap space. But just hypothetically, let's say the Falcons have the cap space to do this, you could go out and give Philadelphia a fourth or fifth round pick to get Michael Kendricks. And when you can already get an established player of Kendricks' skill level, who's already at that, maybe not be quite on the level as Barr, but is maybe a notch below Barr for like a mid-round pick, why would you use a first round pick on a guy that may or may not be Barr when Kendricks is a proven commodity? This is sort of the same argument I myself and others made when the Falcons were sniffing around Michael Bennett, where it's like you can get a pass rusher of his caliber for a mid round pick. It's more than worth it when you would have to normally use a first round pick to do that. And if you can get first round value with the fourth or fifth round pick, why would you ever use a first round pick to try to accomplish the same thing? So I feel like the Falcons going after a linebacker in round one doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You really would have to get like a instant impact, like on the Luke Kuechly level. You would have to get a guy that's instantly, the Falcons would have to feel that guy is going to be on Deion Jones's level. And I'm not talking rookie year Deion Jones. I'm talking like now third year Deion Jones, to sort of justify that sort of high a selection. I think other than that, I think the Falcons are probably going to pull the trigger on the linebacker at some point on day three, maybe multiple picks on linebackers at some point on day three. But before then, you're just not going to get the value unless you're going to get a really, really high level player right away, which knowing this team's history of linebacker play, I know we've gotten decent return on our investment early on from guys like Jones and Campbell. And I've said many times, I think Riley is slightly underrated, given how negative people are about his rookie season. None of our guys have really given us that instant impact, Jones being the closest. And even then, I don't necessarily know if he even had a repeat of Deion Jones's rookie season, whether or not that's going to be worth a first round pick to you. All right, we got a couple more questions, but I want to remind you guys that since we're talking draft, you guys should definitely check out the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast with hosts John Ledger and Trevor Sikkema, providing you all your draft coverage for 2018 and beyond. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. All right, our next question comes from Joe Morgan. Who are some of the defensive tackle prospects that the Falcons could target in the later rounds of the draft that you still believe have good value? By later rounds, I'm thinking more rounds 3 to 5, because I think if the Falcons haven't drafted their defensive tackles, two or more of them, by the time we get to round 4, the Falcons really kind of screwed up this draft. I do feel reasonably opinionated, I guess, that the Falcons need to use two of their first 4 picks on defensive tackles. Now, that could be a first and a fourth, that could be a second and a third, it could be any combination, but I really do feel like if the Falcons want to get the most out of this draft, they kind of have to use two. You know, it's a deep draft class, and you're probably going to, as I explained on a previous episode, you're going to kind of need to use two picks to sort of fulfill the needs that you have at that position, because it's very unlikely that one guy is going to do it for you. I do feel like they have to use two of those picks. So in terms of later round, if you're thinking more day 3 guys, there's a couple of guys that I wouldn't have a problem with taking in rounds 4 or 5. Obviously, I know the Falcons don't really have a 5th round pick. There's a couple of guys that late in the draft, you know, in round 6 or 7, I wouldn't have a problem with the Falcons pulling the trigger on those guys, because I do think those guys are have enough developmental upside that it's worthwhile to pull the trigger on those guys. But to answer your question, Joe, I do think the Falcons need to draft guys in the first 4 rounds of the draft. But some of the guys that I'm looking at, particularly one techniques, because I think ideally you're going to get your 3 technique early in the draft in the first 2 rounds, and then you're going to get your 1 technique probably in round 3 or 4. But guys that I would sort of look at as having 3rd, 4th, or 5th round value, B.J. Hill from NC State, Deidre Sinnott from South Florida, Foley Fadakasi from UConn, P.J. Hall from Sam Houston State, Puna Ford from Texas, Tim Settle from Virginia Tech, Derek Nnadi from Florida State. After that point, some of the true late round guys that I wouldn't have a problem with the Falcons pulling the trigger that could play that one technique role: John Atkins from Georgia, Lowell Lutulule from Utah, and Zay Henderson from Texas A&M as like round 6, round 7 guys. Of those guys I named, probably the 2 guys that are most intriguing for me personally from what I've seen are P.J. Hall and Deidre Sinnott. P.J. Hall tested absolutely amazingly at his pro day at Sam Houston State, so he's very intriguing from that. I've only seen a little bit of him, and I wasn't necessarily blown away with him given the level of competition he was facing. But from what I've seen of his, you know, I'll have to go back and rewatch the Senior Bowl to check him out more. But from what I've seen, he played really well in the Senior Bowl. So that gives me a lot of positive. Senior Bowl, the East-West Shrine game. I can't remember what game. It was East-West Shrine game. Sorry. And the same thing goes for the Sinnott. So those would be the 2 guys that would be at the top of my list of the guys I named. And after that, they're just kind of like, yeah, they're all fine. You know, I don't necessarily have a horse in that race. As I said earlier, I do think if the Falcons want to get a 3 tech, they can't really wait until the mid or late rounds to do so, because I just think those guys tend to dry up, because at that point, you know, some of the guys that I like in the later round range, let me start from the beginning. I think the guys that I like as 3 techniques in this draft that can really come in and do something seriously in Atlanta, I think there's really only 4 guys in this draft. That's Maurice Hurst, that's Deron Payne, that's Taven Bryan, that's Nathan Shepard. I think if the Falcons don't land one of those 4 defensive tackles, I wouldn't say this draft is a failure, but it is one of those things where they're going to have to do something between now and August, because otherwise it's just going to be all Jack Crawford, and I don't know if that's a good bet to make. So, you know, whether that's signing a guy like Benny Logan or John Hankins after the draft, or trading for somebody, you know, between now and the start of the season, you know, similar to what the Seahawks did with Sheldon Richardson last year, I don't know. But I would feel like if the Falcons don't land one of those 4 guys early in the draft, then they can they kind of screwed the pooch. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's pressure on them to trade up. Now, I personally think there isn't a big drop. I think Hurst is the best and far and away the best out of that group. I think Payne and Bryan are sort of on a similar level. I think Payne is more of a high floor guy, and Bryan is more of a high ceiling guy. I won't say that Payne is a low ceiling guy, but I'm not as intrigued with Payne's upside as other people are. And Bryan, it kind of has the potential to have a much lower floor than I think people necessarily want in a first round pick, potentially, from what I've seen. I think Shepherd is kind of in that same boat, which is a high ceiling guy that may have a low floor, but I think has a better floor than what probably people perceive from a guy that played in Division II. And I think, you know, the drop off between Shepherd and Payne and Bryan, I don't think it's significant. So I do feel like even if the Falcons miss the boat on one of those other three in the first round, as well as Vita Vea, that they can sort of hopefully pull the trigger on Nathan Shepherd in round two and feel really comfortable that they got a really good player. As far as sort of mid and late round guys that could play the three technique, most of those guys that I'm looking at are more sort of guys that I would see as playing the Derek Shelby role as five techniques that kick inside on nickel passing downs. And some of those guys include guys like James Looney from Cal, Jamias Pittman from UCF, Rasheem Green from USC, Breland Speaks from Ole Miss. Kentavious Street would have been on that list from NC State, but he suffered a torn ACL this past week. And so at this point, the earliest I would feel comfortable taking him is with that Mr. Relevant pick in round seven. I don't believe in necessarily drafting injured players and thinking that they're going to do much, you know, in year two and beyond. I just, historically, that doesn't work out particularly well for NFL teams. The 49ers did that a bunch in the Harbaugh years and pretty much missed on all those guys. They did it with like three or four guys and not a single one of them developed into a viable, not only role player, but not even a starter for them. I need to watch a little bit more of RJ McIntosh from Miami. He might be another guy that I would throw on that list as well, as a potential, you know, second, third tier, three tech. But yeah, so I hope that answers your question, Joe. You know, I might throw in Andrew Brown as a round four candidate. I'm not in love with Andrew Brown. He has a lot of upside, but he is kind of one of those, like, I don't know. There's a Hageman vibe I get from him a little bit, just in the sense of that he's talented and there's a lot of upside, but I wouldn't necessarily bet on his talent, so to speak, similar to Hageman, where Hageman had tremendous talent, but I don't know if it was a great bet to bet on him. Obviously, if you're taking him in round four as opposed to round two, it's a better bet. At least there's less risk involved in that bet. So we'll see about that. We got one more question, but I do want to remind people before we get there that Major League Baseball is now part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Go ahead, check them out wherever podcasts can be found. Your Major League Baseball team every day. All right, Jeremy Pruitt asks, question for Locked On Podcast. Now that Vic Beasley is going to the famous hands camp, do you think he will improve as a pass rusher this season? Well, Jeremy, this is news to me. You sent this question to me today as I'm recording this on Thursday. I'm curious where you're getting your information from, because I haven't, you know, I scrounged around looking on Twitter and message boards and Googled it, and I didn't see where you were getting this information from. So, not to say that I don't believe you, but I would just like to know where you're sourcing this info so I can sort of get a better idea other than you just telling me Vic Beasley's going to a famous hands camp. I don't know what camp that is. You know, is that Chuck Smith's or is that somebody else's? Who knows? But as far as Vic Beasley working on his hands, I think that's a positive thing. I think that should put him in a better position to improve as a pass rusher than anything else that he could possibly do this offseason, because I do feel like his hands are the biggest question mark involving him, and they haven't really developed a whole lot over the last 3 years, and it's one of the reasons why his production has fluctuated up and down, because he's basically relying on, you know, being that sort of one-note speed rusher, and if he doesn't win with his first step, he's not going to win. because he doesn't have really counter moves and doesn't really know how to use his hands to disengage from blockers, and he doesn't have an abundance of length or size or power to really sort of do much other than rely on his speed. We've talked about this quite a bit over the last 4 or 5 months with Vic Beasley, multiple episodes devoted to this. If this is new to you, so go ahead, Google Locked On Falcons podcast Vic Beasley, and you'll find at least two, if not more, episodes talking ad nauseum about Vic Beasley. It's interesting with Vic Beasley, when you look at his career. He's, according to Pro Football Focus, he's had a total of 126 pressures, which combines sacks, hits, and hurries. Last year he had 28, the year before he had 56, and as a rookie he had 42. Now, if you look at Pro Football Focus data, they also have said that on average, league-wide, about 15% of total pressures are converted into sacks, which means that for basically every 6 to almost 7 pressures a guy gets, one of those is typically a sack. If you look at Vic Beasley's career numbers, basically he should have about 19 career sacks, but of course he has 24 and a half. So he's been able to convert his pressures into sacks at a much higher rate than normal. But if you just go year by year, last year he should have had 4 sacks based off his pressures. The year before he should have 8.5, and as a rookie he should have had 6.5 to add up to that 19 total. And so it's interesting with Vic Beasley when you talk about him, because I think so much involving Vic Beasley and the narratives around him, the perception around him, have everything to do with expectations. I think when we drafted him, the expectations were exceedingly high because people were expecting him due to a variety of reasons to him to basically be an instant John Abraham sort of impactful guy. And when I think he failed to live up to that hype as a rookie with his 4.5 sack season, there was a lot of backlash, and there was a lot of people after that season and going into his second season labeling him as a bust. And then he comes out, starting, a month into his second year and starts racking up big sack performances and a lot of sacks. I think you basically had a backlash to the backlash, and I think people started to overblow and overhype sort of how good his performances were in 2016 just as a response to the people that were previously calling him a bust. And I think that, again, that 2016 season, him leading the NFL in sacks, obviously led to, once again, raised expectations. And while you didn't have people, or at least many people, from what I could tell, saying, oh man, Vic Beasley's a bust again, as you had a year earlier, after him not quite living up to expectations in 2017, you did, I think, have a sort of false narrative surrounding him, which was sort of, oh, the reason why he didn't necessarily live up to the hype was, oh, because he was dropping in the coverage too much, or he was playing linebacker, and he would have lived up to, he would have racked up bunches of sacks if the Falcons hadn't been dropping in the coverage. But it's like, they dropped him in the coverage like 30 times total last year, guys. It's like, it's not... It is not like he would have gotten 30 sacks on those 30 plays, or even 10 sacks on those 30 plays had he been rushing the quarterback. And truth be told, he probably would have gotten like maybe 1 sack on those 30 plays at most, if we're being honest. And I think, one of the things, at least for me, is I kind of think, and based off of his career, like we may be, just be due to expectations, not realizing and not admitting that maybe Vic Beasley is quote unquote just a 6 to 8 sack guy, which isn't a bad thing. But because the expectations are that he'll be a 10 or 15 sack guy, for a lot of people, 6 to 8 sacks, and particularly where he was drafted in the top 10, is just not going to be good enough. And I think one of the issues that we're going to have to run into potentially this year is if he quote unquote only has 7.5 sacks, a lot of people are going to look at that as very, very disappointing. And I think part of the reason why I'm not as keen as Vic Beasley being a defensive end and wanting him to get more opportunities as a linebacker, because I feel like if he's quote-unquote just a 6 to 8 sack guy, that's not necessarily a guy, and based off of his development so far as a pass rusher, not simply the production-wise, because 6 to 8 sacks is nothing to sniff at. That's a starter in the NFL. But based off of his sort of intermittent production, like, that to me is not a guy that you necessarily need to have rushing the quarterback every down. And so if that means he has to drop into coverage 5 to 8 times a game and he's spending 10 to 20 snaps playing the run, as opposed to spending all, you know, most, if not all of his snaps, his 40 or 50 snaps rushing the quarterback, I don't feel like you're losing a whole lot, because honestly, if we're looking simply at 2017, I think Vic Beasley was like the sixth best pass rusher on the team last year, behind Claiborne Tack, Jarrett Poe, and Brooks Reed. And like, to me personally, I think even going back to 2016, the gap between Vic Beasley and Brooks Reed is not as big as the sack production seems to indicate in a lot of people, in many people's eyes, but certainly not in my eyes. Now, if he improves his hands, I think he certainly can widen that gap to a certain extent. And, you know, I don't know if he's going to make those strides this year. If he goes to this camp that Jeremy indicates that he's headed to, then certainly I'll be a lot more optimistic that he can. You know, what's interesting is going to be, because there's going to be a lot of pressure on Vic Beasley going into this year, so he definitely needs to do something. With Claiborne and Poe, the Falcons, according to Pro Football Focus, lost 92 total pressures, which, based again off their other metrics, indicates that that's about 14 sacks between those two guys. And while, because Tack is still young and Grady Jarrett has never really been a prolific pass rusher dating back to his days in college at Clemson, I think he only had one career sack. I don't know how much you can sort of put on those guys' plate to sort of carry the load. And so there's going to put a lot of pressure on Vic Beasley to at least carry a significant portion of that slack. And so you're probably looking at him, if the three of those guys have to split 14 sacks and 92 pressures just to keep the Falcons pass rush treading water, that probably means that Vic Beasley is going to need, you know, 5 or more sacks and 30 or more pressures. You know, ideally, you know, maybe 40 pressures on, in addition to what he had last year. And so what that really sort of translates to is the expectations and sort of the pressure on Vic Beasley is that he's going to have to find a way to, you know, get to double-digit sacks again in 2018. And I think if he does, that's, you know, that's great and awesome, and certainly we'll all be cheering for him. If he doesn't, you know, at least from my perspective, that's okay. He just may be a 6 to 8 sack guy instead of a 10 to 12 sack guy that I think people want and maybe arguably the Falcons need him to be. And so, you know, we'll find out. And I'm sure if he doesn't live up to those expectations, it's going to be a very common topic of conversation towards the end of 2018 and certainly going into 2019. And this sort of, you know, to put a button on this, this is one of the reasons why I'm kind of against drafting an edge rusher this year, because I want to afford Vic Beasley every opportunity to live up to the expectations afforded to him. And I think if he does, then that means basically you don't need to ever use a high pick on an edge rusher for a considerable amount of time, assuming Tack McKinley continues to develop and Vic Beasley, you know, sticks in Atlanta beyond, you know, the 2 years left on his contract. And so therefore, you know, you can go another 5 or 6 years without having to use a number one pick on an edge rusher or a high pick on an edge rusher. Now, if he doesn't quite live up to those expectations, then I think using that high pick, that first or second round pick on an edge rusher in 2019, at that point, you know, instead of looking for a number three pass rusher to upgrade over Brooks Reed, you're really, in fact, going to be looking at a number one or number two pass rusher that could potentially supplant or replace Vic Beasley. And I think that would justify using a high pick for an edge rusher. But again, until we know what Vic Beasley is, and this 2018 season is sort of going to be the make or break year for Vic Beasley, even though he's got 2 more years left on his contract, I do feel like, you know, we need to find that out before we start throwing draft picks at edge rushers. Because again, if you don't need to use a high pick on an edge rusher, why would you? So that's sort of my thoughts on that. But we'll see what Vic Beasley does. I hope, Jeremy, you're not making this up, and you can inform me of where you got this information from, or just maybe I just missed it or whatever. But hopefully, yeah, he does improve on that and does the work. And you know, I like Vic Beasley. I haven't been as praising of him in previous years, largely because I think people were a little bit overhyping his 2016, just as a response to sort of the anti Vic Beasley bust talk. And we see that constantly within our fan base. It, you know, opinions tend to get very polarized. You're either this guy's the worst or this guy's the best, and there's really no in between. And Vic Beasley has certainly been another example of that. We'll see what happens. You know, I'm not necessarily confident that our pass rush is going to make huge strides this year, but I'm cautiously optimistic. And certainly, if it's true that Vic Beasley is doing the things that he needs to do this offseason to work on his hands and develop better technique as a pass rusher instead of just relying on his athleticism as he has done throughout his NFL career and often did at Clemson, then I'm a lot more optimistic than I was certainly yesterday. So guys, I appreciate that. And we'll be back next week to talk more draft. We'll start to get some guests on so that you guys don't have to listen to me talk for as long, to really start to dial in on this particular draft class. And hopefully these next 2 weeks, we can sort of fill with premium draft content, focusing on the draft, the Falcons, and as well as the NFL as a whole. And until then, guys, stay locked on.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.